From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Are you 486 or against it? It doesn't matter anymore because it's now available in the United States. Goths, Guns, and Money, part two of our discussion of Hollywood, violence, and the elections. And we go to Los Angeles to look at the transit strike. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Capping a bitter 12-year battle, the government yesterday approved use of the abortion pill RU486, a major victory for abortion rights advocates that could dramatically alter abortion in this country. The long-expected decision by the Food and Drug Administration allows Americans an early abortion method already used in France, Britain, China, and 10 other countries. The action's expected to make abortion in the U.S. more accessible and more private. Coming in the final weeks of the presidential campaign, the move also is sure to renew fierce political debate. Republican candidate George W. Bush, whose father's administration banned RU486 in 1989, opposes abortion, while Vice President Gore has supported the pill option. And in a rare inside look at the auditing firms that inspect overseas factories to see whether they are sweatshops, an MIT professor contends the world's largest factory monitoring firm does a shoddy job and overlooks many safety and wage violations. The professor, Dara O'Rourke, said in a report issued yesterday that inspectors from the firm PricewaterhouseCoopers had a pro-management bias, did not uncover the use of carcinogenic chemicals, and failed to recognize that some employees are forced to work 80 hours weeks. He also said the firm overlooked other basic problems, including time cards that were falsified and machines that were missing safety guards to protect workers' fingers. And this international news, the Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori flew to Washington unexpectedly to meet with OAS officials as rumors of a pending coup swirl in Peru. Before his pre-dawn departure, a lawmaker said the army was plotting to take power and let spymaster Vladimiro Montesinos return from Panama. Peru's Congress voted to disband the spy agency. This news in the New York Post, which says it has learned the Serbian opposition figures and European governments are working on a secret deal that would allow Slobodan Milosevic to leave Yugoslavia and escape punishment for war crimes. The New York Post says NATO diplomats and members of Serbian opposition groups said the talks are aimed at persuading the leader to accept the results of Sunday's elections, in which it is believed opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica finished first. The discussions, spearheaded by Russia and Greece, which have close ties to the Serbian leadership, are centering on a deal in which Milosevic would publicly agree to step down from power soon and then would be allowed to leave Yugoslavia, possibly for Belarus. Under the plan, Milosevic would not have to face charges at the UN War Crimes Tribunal. And now we go to the Debate Commission, the Commission on Presidential Debates in Washington, D.C., where Adam Eidinger is. He is with the Open Debate Society. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Adam.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us why you're there today?
Well, yesterday we had hundreds of people here throughout the day, as well as eight individuals who were arrested trying to enter the building. We want to deliver 85,000 signatures of individuals who would like to see Ralph Nader in the debates. And we were promised by the debate commission, I think, to defuse the situation yesterday, that it was quite a scene here.
You were arrested yesterday?
Yes, I was, along with seven other students and some activists here from George Washington University and University of Maryland. Anyway, they said they would meet with us today, that they would accept the petitions, and they would discuss this issue with us face-to-face. We've just sent one person inside the building to talk with them, and the people, the security is claiming, oh, you don't have an appointment today. No, 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 we know nothing about this appointment. So it's hard to say what's going to happen next. We're going to hang here for a little longer and try calling the commission directly. And, you know, this can't go on. And if it does go on, and if they do allow these debates to happen without these candidates the public wants to see, there are going to be, I really predict, thousands of people in Boston. And I encourage all your listeners to turn out on October 3rd.
Yes, that was what I was going to ask you, Adam. The first debate is going to be in Boston next week. And isn't it perhaps time for those who feel strongly about this issue to make themselves heard in a way that the national press cannot avoid dealing with the issue?
I think this is the crunch time. If we don't get a sizable showing out there with these protests, if we can't, you know, tell the debate commission with our voices in the streets that this is an undemocratic system they've put in place for the debates, this is the one opportunity the public can see the candidates go head-to-head, unfiltered, uncensored, and they're denying us that, this is it. And I think this is sort of make or break for the Nader campaign in many ways, too. And I know that there are going to be massive rallies on October 1st, a big rally that at the Fleece Center in Boston that the Nader campaign is putting together. And I'm fairly sure that many of those folks who will be turning out, many thousands who will be there, will turn out as well on October 3rd.
Adam Eidinger, I want to thank you for being with us. You are in Washington at the Commission on Presidential Debates. Where is that, by the way?
It's located at 1200 New Hampshire Avenue. That's near 20th and N Street. And it's a really anonymous-looking office building, and there's no sign on the door of the Commission on Presidential Debates. It's just two consulting firms, the Brewer Consulting Group and Wagner Communications, a Democratic and Republican firm sharing the same, I mean, I should say two firms sharing the same office, and that have nonprofit status somehow. It's a really absurd situation.
Well, Adam Eidinger with the Open Debate Society in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Yesterday, we began a discussion centered around the latest round of culture wars between Washington and Hollywood. Earlier this week, the Motion Picture Association of America pledged to the Senate Commerce Committee they would curb but not guarantee an end to marketing movies with violent content to underage audiences. Disney, Fox, and Warner Brothers promised to implement tighter procedures in marketing R-rated films. However, other major film corporations, Universal Pictures, Columbia, Paramount, and MGM, said they'd never specifically targeted young people for violent films and refused to rule out advertising R-rated movies on programs or internet sites with a large youth audience. The Senate Commerce Committee hearings come after the high school shootings in Littleton, Colorado, largely a response to fears that raw popular culture had furnished an unhealthy mental climate which influenced the boy's actions. A Republican caused a storm of controversy in his famous line that goths, not guns, were to blame for the Littleton shootings. And then there's all the big money industry money, the big movie industry money that goes into the presidential campaigns, which lead to the Democrats softening their tough attack on Hollywood. Hollywood has furnished Democrats with $14 million in this election cycle, a fair share of it enabling both Gore and Lieberman to sell themselves to America on television. Gore's presidential campaign can't afford to alienate his million-dollar supporters. He gets more money than any other politician from the entertainment industry. Dan Gerstein is on the line with us, spokesperson for Senator and Vice Presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman. Do you think this is a fair characterization?
Honestly, I don't, Amy, and here's why. The real test here is not where you get your support from, but where you draw the line. And I think with the Vice President Gore and Senator Lieberman, they stood up to their supporters. They told them in no uncertain terms they were wrong, and they demanded that they change. And I think that's the test that people have to judge them by on is, will they do the right thing, even if it means alienating their supporters? And I think you have to contrast that with our opponents who have not stood up to their supporters in the gun industry, in the big oil industry, and in the pharmaceutical industry, and at the HMOs, and have not been willing to take a stand and do the right thing if it means costing or alienating their supporters. And I really think that is the test.
Well, Dan, what about there was a New York Times article this week that indicated that among voters, this is not really a big issue. the problems of violence, at least an election year issue, the problems of violence on film and in television. Why do you feel that it's so important to continue to raise it at this time?
Well, I don't think that characterization is accurate either. Polls have been showing for the last several years that the biggest issue of concern to the American people is the weakening of moral standards in this country and the decline in morality. And people kind of perceive that in different ways, but there's sort of a swelling sense in this country that with these school shootings and with the decline in civility in public life and the coarsening of our culture, that there's a problem here, and with the weakening of the family as well. And
but you're making a big jump now from a decline in moral standards, weakening of the family, to film and television.
Well, that's the point I was just about to get to, is that I think more and more Americans, particularly parents, make a connection between their concerns about the moral health of the country and the kind of culture that we're raising our kids in. And that's not to say the entire culture is sick. You know, certainly men would never characterize it that way. I don't think the vice president would either. But to say there is a considerable amount of gratuitous violence, violence that's celebrated in our culture. There's a lot of sexually explicit messages that treat sex as a recreational activity devoid of consequences. And these messages have an impact. And I think this feeds into the larger concern that a lot of Americans, particularly parents, have about the moral health and about the standards and the coarsening of our society. And I think we're speaking directly to those concerns, and we're not calling for censorship. We're not blaming these ills on the entertainment industry. We're saying they're a contributing factor, and that if we're going to solve some of these problems, we need their help. I think teen pregnancy is a good example. You know, teen pregnancy rates have been coming down, and I think the entertainment industry deserves some credit there. I mean, NBC in particular has made a commitment to work into their storylines and some of their shows messages about responsible sexual behavior and about the consequences of premature sexual behavior. And that is having an impact. And I think we can point to that as a positive contribution that the entertainment industry has made to help deal with some of these larger problems.
NYU Professor Mark Crispin Miller.
Well, you know, there's an element of truth in all this, but essentially the culture wars issue is a sideshow. You know, I actually have to differ with Dan on his point that the candidates should be judged on their willingness to stand up and risk alienating certain constituents in Hollywood. I don't think occasional bursts of moralizing on anyone's part is really going to make any difference to the people in Hollywood, because it's not really finally going to threaten their profits. As I said yesterday, we have to recognize this. There's a very important correlation between the whole structure of the media business, its inordinate domination by a handful of gigantic transnational corporations that are all indebted, that are all desperate for revenues, and that therefore do go after children in the same way that the cigarette companies did, for economic reasons also, go after children. So the problem seems to me to be not so much a matter of violent and sexually explicit programming per se. I mean, I wouldn't want some, you know, a board of censors to decide for me that The Sopranos was so unwholesome that we wanted to take it off the air, because the show is a masterpiece. I'd much rather see a commercial culture that was not suffused every hour of every day with millions of commercial messages that, you know, actually do more to promote very unwholesome attitudes, a kind of psychopathic selfishness, a kind of brainless and pleasureless hedonism. I mean, those messages, which probably constitute the most pervasive propaganda in the history of the world, those are something to worry about in a democracy that calls itself Judeo-Christian. So it seems to me, just to sum up, that what we really have to do is start talking about genuine media reform. We have to move in the direction of antitrust. We have to enlarge and enrich non-commercial programming. The fact is that, like the rest of the economy, so here, so in the media, do we have something approaching a kind of corporate monopoly. And the values that drive corporations are not healthy values. It's not just a matter of a few so-called degenerates making, you know, objectionable music. It's something far more profound than that.
Well, Mark, one of the things that struck me in terms of those companies that decided that they would promise to implement tighter procedures, Disney, Fox, and Warner Brothers, all of film studios that also have major television and cable properties and therefore would be subject to a lot more government scrutiny than would, let's say, Sony, Columbia Pictures or Universal Pictures or Paramount. Any thoughts on that?
Wait, you're saying that they're subject to more scrutiny. Why?
Well, Disney, Fox, and Time Warner obviously all have heavy cable and television operations.
Well, some of the other ones do, too. Just to speak to this particular issue, mm-hmm. I think that these companies are morally and legally obliged not to market their wares to children. I mean, they're violating their own guidelines. But again, I have to make clear that this is a sideshow. This is a trivial issue. I mean, I'm glad that when I bring my child to a movie theater, I don't have to worry, you know, about his being traumatized by an inappropriate preview. I mean, I think that's the very least that they should do. But this is just an example of, you know, the usual quadrennial posturing, it seems to me.
Professor Henry Jenkins is also with us, director of the Comparative Media Studies at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. What do you think of what has transpired this week? You testified months ago before Congress on the issue of violence and the media. Where has the discussion gone now, and what is the difference now in an election year?
Well, I think let me begin by saying that I think there would be a tremendous value for a cultural conversation that dealt with the complexity of contemporary culture and some of the dilemmas parents face. But I think the minute we bring it into a congressional hearing room where we have this threat of government regulation, where we have partisan politics, it becomes a culture war. And the rhetoric that has come out has intensified over the last 2 years in ways that are simplifying and divisive rather than helping us to actually get to the root of the problem. And I think I can point to a number of examples of that simplification. One is we keep talking about protecting our children from violent entertainment. However, the category, when we say the word child, the emotional power rests in our assumption we're talking about nine-year-olds. In fact, much of what we're talking about are adolescents, which most of us who are dealing with this in a more complex way would say is a different category with different levels of responsibility, different levels of cultural competency, and different levels of rights and freedoms than a nine-year-old child would be. Similarly, I think we keep talking about ratings as if they were objective and universal, rather than a statement of values, a statement of values in which some groups' values are held more highly than others. It troubles me. I often find myself as offended by the sexism and racism of a G-rated Disney film as I am by the violence or profanity in an R-rated film. We also keep talking about this as if we were talking simply about commodities, and I would never deny that this is an economic relationship. I share most of Miller's critique of the media concentration. I think that's a very important question. But these things are never simply commodities. They draw on ideas that are in the culture. They tap into feelings, attitudes people have. And at the moment in which they're consumed, people invest in them. They see themselves reflected in them. And their investment in them is precisely what makes this a really difficult question to deal with. When we pathologize taste, we are often in the position of stigmatizing the consumers who have those tastes, which was the point I was trying to make yesterday about the comments Orrin Hatch made about Marilyn Manson. It's not that I'm not necessarily feeling an obligation to defend Marilyn Manson. He certainly can defend himself. But when you make a statement that anyone who thinks in America is offended by the music of Marilyn Manson, you have made a direct slap at young people who are invested in that music for better or for worse. When we have congressional hearings which sort of endorse prejudice against people on the basis of their taste, whether it's Hatch's constant homophobic references when he talks about Orrin Hatch, or the kinds of racism implicit in holding hip-hop up as the worst form of popular culture, it translates into behavior within society. So we know after the first set of hearings after Columbine, there was a significant increase both in violence directed against goths and gays in the public schools by bullies who took the bully pulpit of government as evidence that they should indeed continue their bullying campaign. And we saw an enormous crackdown by school officials who were panicked by the popular culture being consumed by students. We saw students being suspended for things they said in class or wrote in school essays. We saw students being punished, pathologized, treated, and subjected to therapy because of their taste in music. And I think until Lieberman and Gore and the others who've unleashed this moral panic are prepared to stand up and make a distinction between their concern for products and their concern for the people who consume it, it is very, very difficult for me to take seriously their desire to produce a better culture.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Our guests are Professor Henry Jenkins, Director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Media Studies at New York University, and Dan Gerstein, spokesperson for Vice Presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll also take on the issue of RU 486, and we'll go to Los Angeles for the transit strike. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our discussion on Hollywood and the elections. But before we finish up with that, I did want to ask Dan Gerstein, spokesperson for Vice Presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman, about the question raised at the top of the show today, which is hundreds of people, mainly young people, at the Commission on Presidential Debates again today. They were there yesterday. A number of people got arrested demanding that third-party candidates like Nader and Buchanan get into this debate next week. And I was wondering why Gore Lieberman and, well, not that you can speak for, Bush Cheney have opposed this.
I don't know that they've opposed that. And I wouldn't want to speak without knowing all the facts.
Well, the parties are laying the ground rules for this debate. It's a Democratic-Republican event.
Well, my understanding was the Presidential Commission was laying the ground rules, and that the two campaigns were kind of filling in the blanks. But again, like I said, I don't feel really comfortable speaking out on that subject without knowing all the facts.
Dan Gerstein, I would like to ask you to continue the discussion we are having. What your response is to this issue of you are focusing on the violence in Hollywood and on television, but very little on the overall consumer commercialism propaganda aspect of the films and television. And some people would say that the violence in films doesn't do as much danger as all of these Americans who insist on arming themselves at record levels. That's a greater propensity to violence in American society than film or television?
Well, let me get to that. I will definitely get to that question. I just want to respond to a couple of things that your other guest has said. You know, first of all, you know, I couldn't agree more with what Professor Miller said, and I think we have to have a larger debate in this society about media policy. And in particular, you know, one of the questions Senator Lieberman's concerned about is, you know, we have a public interest obligation for broadcasters. They receive spectrum in return for a commitment to serve the public interest, and there's a lot of evidence that they're not serving the public interest, not just by the, you know, the quality of programming and the amount of sex and violence that is being put on the air, but in terms of, you know, coverage of elections, providing free airtime to candidates, providing for a good public discourse, providing educational programming. And that is an issue that's before the Federal Communications Commission right now and deserves to have a fuller debate. So I couldn't agree more with him. But I do want to say, though, you can acknowledge that without saying that, you know, the concerns of parents about the cultural influences on their kids is trivial, because it's not trivial. I can tell you this is not an election year thing. This is something that's been brewing for years, that Senator Lieberman's been hearing in Connecticut around the country. And just to be fair to him, I think you have to acknowledge that he's been talking about this for years. This is not something that's just kind of come up in the heat of the campaign. It's an ongoing concern of his. And that he's tried to approach it in a very balanced way without blaming people, but to say we've got to have a conversation about this. And in the question about guns, Al Gore and Joe Lieberman have a very strong record on proposing and supporting common sense gun safety laws. They are concerned about easy access to guns, and they've raised that, and they're disappointed that the Congress has not acted on closing the gun show loophole. And they're one, you know, they're, it's only the Democrats are acknowledging that this is a complicated problem and that everyone has a role to play and that there are different responsibilities. And then too often our friends on the Republican side won't even acknowledge that there is a problem with easy access to guns, and they do want to place all the blame on the culture, and that's just not fair.
Mark Crispin-Miller?
Yeah, I just want to say a couple of quick things. First of all, I believe unbeknownst to both parties and to most of us, there is in fact a tremendous amount of potential mass support for a genuinely radical movement of media reform. And I say this on the basis of a couple of national polls that my group, the Project on Media Ownership, did last year with, in fact, the help of Celinda Lake, the pollster who I believe is now working for the Gore campaign. We were quite startled to find out how strongly Americans feel about things like the giveaway of the digital TV spectrum, which is, in fact, something that has happened on the Clinton-Gore watch with tremendous Republican support. The digital TV spectrum is a development of incalculable importance for the future of programming. That spectrum is an extension of the airwaves, and it has been given away, it has been privatized, in exchange for literally nothing. Now, when Americans find out about that, because they tend not to know it, and more importantly, when they understand that the airwaves are public property, worth, by conservative estimate, $70 billion, and when they find out how few corporations there are in control, and when they find out that they get this great resource for nothing, they not only become extremely indignant, I'm talking about, you know, levels of from 70% to 85%, but they support measures to require the media corporations not only to pay to use the airwaves, which is only right, but also to provide much of the public interest programming that has been wiped out by deregulation. They're required to do community-oriented programming. They're required to do educational programming for children. They're required to do educational programming for adults. They're required to cease all advertising to children, which is an enlightened policy. And I'm not talking about adolescents here. I'm talking about children. As in Sweden, where it's just completely illegal, where you don't do it because children can't handle advertising and it's just wrong. The fact is that a politician who had the guts and the independence, and I suppose the personal wealth, unfortunately, to be able to stand up and make proposals like this, proposals that I believe Ralph Nader is very sympathetic to, you know, such a politician would actually be tapping into a tremendous wave of mass support, the likes of which we really haven't seen since the progressive era. I think it's extremely important to bear this in mind because this is, after all, a democracy. One really quick thing. About 5 years ago in Baltimore, there was an amazing grassroots movement to get billboards for cigarettes and liquor out of residential neighborhoods because those billboards were crammed only in poor neighborhoods, black and white. And the argument was that it was bad for the kids because those images clearly tried to encourage kids to drink and smoke, which is illegal behavior. These are high crime areas. These are black people, their own kids, Hispanic people, their own kids, poor whites, their own kids. This was not some kind of elitist face-off between a bunch of graybeards in D.C. and a bunch of, you know, heroic Marilyn Manson fans. Well, you know, encouragingly enough, they carried the day despite an amazing wave of propaganda and organization by the Tobacco Institute, the Outdoor Advertising Association, Philip Morris, Anheuser-Busch, which bust in a whole bunch of supporters, including security goons. It was quite a scene at the City Hall there. They carried the day. The City Council passed the law, and 4 years later, the Supreme Court upheld it, which led to similar legislation being passed in 35 or 40 cities across the country. That seems to me to represent democratic media policy at its best. Now, of course, it was local, but I make this point because it demonstrates that we're not talking about some kind of simple culture war. We're talking about democracy.
Professor Jenkins.
I share absolutely Professor Miller's position on this, that I think serious media reform is absolutely a central part of any discussion of this phenomenon. The goal should be increasing the diversity of our culture so that each family has the ability to choose cultural products that meaningfully reflect its values, its needs, its goals, and the goal should be to educate parents about the contents of popular culture. I don't think the steps that are being taken right now are adequate to do either of those. I don't think, for example, the problem of diversity isn't that cultural conservatives lack access to forms of popular culture that reflect their values. There's a thriving industry in Christian music. There's a Christian video game industry. There are Christian magazines. There are conservative publications out there. What is being shut out are other representations of other groups, of racial minorities, of sexual minorities, of people who are questioning the status quo, ideas that are critical of the cultural conservative agenda that's been put forward in this culture war. And if the goal has been, the effect of a rhetoric of culture war is to narrow or shut down options, either by direct government action or indirectly by bullying industries into making cultural choices that are narrower than we were before, we haven't reached any place. Secondly, the issue of education, I think, is very important, but the education shouldn't come from government and it shouldn't come from industry. It should come from citizens groups who can take advantage of the kind of revived public sphere that Mark Crispin Miller is talking about. We should be debating, when we make ratings, they should reflect on a statement of our values so we understand where they're coming from, not be a universalized objective standard that imposes one set of ideas about what's valuable in a culture on the society as a whole.
Professor Jenkins and Professor Mark Crispin Miller, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Two last questions for Dan Gerstein, spokesperson for Joe Lieberman. Where does he stand on the low-power FM issue? The big industry, the big media, National Association of Broadcasters pushing very hard against the competition of bringing diversity by going to communities around the country and letting them set up low-power FM stations.
I will answer that question in a second. I do want to respond quickly to what Professor...
We have 30 seconds, so real quick.
How long?
30 seconds.
Well, I want people to be clear that what we're talking about is not things that are, you know, questions versus our values versus someone else's values. These are common values that it's wrong, just like it's wrong to market tobacco and alcohol to children. It's wrong to market violence to children. It's wrong to market music that celebrates abuse and rape of women. I mean, that's not like a questionable line. That's just wrong. And so I just want to be clear about that point. Now, in regards to the low-power FM, my sense is that Senator Lieberman is very sympathetic the concerns of low-power stations. I do not know whether he's actually supported the legislation that's before Congress and what the FCC is doing, but my sense is he would be supportive.
Looking at policy.com, it says, at a Time magazine party honoring the intersection between Washington and Hollywood, former presidential pollster Pat Caddell, a man who has had considerable success on both coasts, described what he sees as the official response to Lieberman's selection. He said, Hollywood gives so much money to the Democratic Party, there isn't anyone worried about Joe Lieberman, even if he's right. The industry has given almost $6 million to the Democrats this election cycle, a figure that ranks them fourth among industries in campaign donations. I'll end on that note. I want to thank you very much, Dan Gerstein, for being with us, spokesperson for Joseph Lieberman, vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party, Mark Crispin Miller of New York University, and Henry Jenkins, professor of media at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move into one of the headline stories of today, after 12 years of bitter struggle, RU 486, the abortion pill, finally received FDA approval for sale in the U.S. yesterday. The pill is used in the first 49 days to terminate a pregnancy, has been widely used overseas, but banned in the United States in 1989 under the Bush administration. According to French Ministry of Health officials in Paris, RU486 is used in about 10% of the 200,000 annual abortions done in France. In more than a decade, researchers there have found the pill has not replaced surgery as the most common method of abortion. It also has not increased the number of abortions. Availability to women of the so-called abortion pill in the U.S. has been delayed, though, by the tense political climate here. The pill, to be marketed under the name Mefaprex, will be available only through physicians, and it will be made available in a month. We're joined by Vicky Saporta, who is the executive director of the National Abortion Federation. You have trained 1,800 health professionals, doctors in this country to provide this pill?
Not just doctors, also advanced practice nurses, counselors, administrators, all of the healthcare professionals that would be involved in the service delivery.
How is it delivered?
Basically, a woman would go to a physician or to a clinic, have all of her options explained to her. If she chooses to have the early option pill, they would do a medical history, make sure there weren't any contraindications. She would be given, her pregnancy would be dated to make sure she's in the first 49 days. She would be given the first pill in the physician's office. And then either she would come back 2 days later to get the second medication, or she would be given that medication to take at home. Within 24 hours of the second medication, 90% of women complete their abortion, and then they would come back 2 weeks later to make certain that, in fact, they had terminated their pregnancy.
Now, the battle to get this pill approved is one of the longest in FDA history. Could you tell a little bit about the pressures on the government by various groups to have an impact on holding up RU486?
Well, as you said, it was clinical trials were not allowed during the Reagan and Bush administrations. The Clinton administration lifted that ban. Clinical trials were conducted. The FDA ruled that it was approvable in 1996. They've been working out the manufacturing and distribution details, but every year for the past 3 years, we've had a motion in the House of Representatives led by Representative Coburn to not allow the FDA to get funding to complete the process. And so there's been a lot of political pressure to keep this out of the United States, as well as, you know, threaten boycotts and suits and that type of thing for anyone who would agree to manufacture the drug.
Now, the company Danko Laboratories, marketer of the drug, partnered with Population Council, a nonprofit group that promotes family planning, received grants and loans from prominent investors like Warren Buffett, George Soros, David Packard of Hewlett-Packard. What is this company, Danko, and how are they distributing it?
They have found a manufacturer that has been approved by the FDA and a tableter, and they will have several distributors in the United States, and a physician will need to certify that, in fact, they can assess gestational age, determine ectopic pregnancy, deal with any complications, and can perform a surgical backup or arrange for a surgical backup in the 5% of cases where this medication would not be effective in terminating the pregnancy. And then they will be able to directly receive the medication from the distributors, and women will be able to receive it in a physician's office or at a clinic.
We're joined right now by a woman who doesn't want to be named, but who took the pill about a year ago in a clinical trial. Welcome to Democracy Now! We'll call you Primera, as one of the first who got this drug. What was it like? What happened to you?
Well, medically, the experience was extremely simple. And I'm afraid an awful lot of people have confused that with the idea that ethically or morally or emotionally, it was a very simple experience as well. It wasn't. The experience of deciding to terminate a pregnancy is never an easy one, no matter what method is used. And too many people are politicizing this and making it seem like having a different method available is going to make this more common. I can't imagine that that'll happen. But medically, I went to see a doctor as soon as I had found out that I was pregnant. I have two children already. They were very, very young at the time, and I was just not able to care for a third child at that time. I had been using birth control, and you know, my husband and I had been using the same method for 10 years. It's not that effective, apparently. When I went in, I went for one visit when I underwent counseling to decide, you know, that I really honestly did want to terminate the pregnancy, and then I was presented options. Surgical abortion was one, and medical was another. I did decide to go with medical, and I underwent a physical exam and an ultrasound for dating. They did confirm that I was within the range. I was eligible for medical abortion. I went back for a second visit, had another exam, and took the medication that time. I was given the second medication to take home with me. I took the second one at home a day later. It was in the evening. they told me about quite a few side effects that I might expect, sent me home with Tylenol and codeine. They told me to take the Tylenol and codeine actually at the same time as the second medication in order to head off any painful side effects. I never took it. I don't like taking things and then not being able to know what's going on, so I kept it ready in case I needed it, but it turned out I never did need it. It really wasn't that painful. It wasn't anything more than a normal period. The next morning, I did expel the fetus, the embryo. The pregnancy was terminated. I went back in a couple of days later, and that was confirmed by ultrasound that I was no longer pregnant. I really didn't have any side effects at all. So from a medical standpoint, this is completely, from my point of view, totally safe and effective. Medically, I had a very good experience with it. But as I said, I'm really concerned that a lot of people are going to think then that that'll make the whole emotional experience of undergoing an abortion an easy one. It isn't. I'm still grieving about what happened, but I understood that that was going to be part of the process.
I want to thank you for sharing that with us. When we come back, we're also going to be joined by the French doctor who's been working with us for 10 years. And then we'll go out to Los Angeles for the transit strike. We're talking about RU486. It was just approved yesterday by the Food and Drug Administration. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. RU486 is now approved in the United States. It'll be available within a month to doctors around the country. Our guests, a woman who took part in RU486 trials, took the drug about a year ago. Vicky Saporta is with us, director of National Abortion Federation. And we're also joined by Dr. Elizabeth Aubigny, who is a gynecologist and president and founder of the French Association of Birth Control in Paris.
Yeah, first, I'd like to ask Vicky Saporta, in terms the anti-abortion movement in this country has been very successful at singling out, targeting, and harassing clinics and doctors who would provide abortions in the country. What safeguards are there going to be for the doctors who begin, who agree to dispense RU486 in terms of preventing them from being targeted in the same way?
Well, we in fact sent a member alert out to our members yesterday to advise them to take appropriate security precautions. Anytime abortion is in the headlines, we have the potential for increased violence. And those who oppose choice have already threatened to target those who don't currently perform abortions but want to add this to their practices. But quite frankly, they really don't have the people power to be picketing outside facilities all over the country. They can barely get enough people to rallies that they call now because of the extreme violence and the people that have lost their lives as a result of that violence. So I think that, you know, they will step up some of their activities. We've been in touch with law enforcement officials as well to let them know that there's a potential increase of violence here to see if we can, in fact, prevent a tragic incident from occurring.
Dr. Elizabeth Aubigny, when you hear this discussion in the United States, what are you thinking?
I am thinking first, I am very happy that women in U.S. can get the RU. because it is a new choice for them at the time of abortion, which is always a very bad time for them.
Okay. The experience in France at the beginning, was there any kind of movement like you see in the United States against abortion?
Yes, we have pro-life in France, but they are against abortion, any kind of abortion, surgical abortion and medical abortion. They are not specially against medical abortion.
Has RU486 diminished the opposition because it is such a different kind of procedure?
No, it doesn't diminish, it doesn't change anything. They think it is an abortion, and they are against any kind of abortion.
I was watching the opponents of abortion last night on television responding. They're developing a new strategy, of course. It's not as simple as just going outside of a women's health clinic now. And it seemed what they were saying was, now women will die taking this drug.
Oh, it is stupid to say that. Now, you know, we have this protocol from 1992, and 600,000 women have received this protocol and never happened any major accident. It is a safe method and an efficacious method.
And the side effects that women do feel when they have bad side effects, what are they?
The bad side effects, it is pain. You know, pelvic pain, because the drugs make contracting the uterus. 20% of women have no pain at all, and we don't know which one will have no pain. 60% have pain as menstruation, and 20% have pains, and we give to them painkillers as much as they want, but we never have to use morphinic painkillers. So it is not very hard. The second side effect, it is metrorrhagia, hemorrhagia. It happens never at the time of the expulsion. It happens later, 15 days later, as you make surgical abortion. It is the most important side effect. But I will say that it is psychological problem with this kind of abortion. Women have the right to choose what kind of abortion they want. Some women don't want to be involved in their abortion. They have not to choose this kind of abortion. Some women prefer to have a quick abortion. I think it is not for them, you know. So I think it is a new choice for women, and some women are like it very much, but it is not. It is a choice for women, that's all.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us from Paris, Dr. Elizabeth Aubigny, founder and president of the French Association of Birth Control, Vicky Saporta in the United States, executive director of the National Abortion Federation, and thanks to the woman who described her own experience taking RU486. As we move now into the last segment of our program, to Los Angeles, where the transit strike is now in its third week, making it the longest transit strike in Los Angeles in 20 years. On Wednesday, bus and rail drivers rejected Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon's plea for an end to their 12-day strike. Reardon had asked the drivers to return to work and obtain a new contract through negotiation. The United Transportation Union, representing 4,300 workers, said the union will not return to work without a labor contract. The strike began as the MTA made clear its intent to cut costs. The MTA is demanding that drivers work 4 10-hour shifts while forfeiting their right to receive time and a half overtime for any hours worked beyond the 8 each day. It also wants to hire more part-time operators and drivers at entry-level wages and cut overtime costs by 15%. Drivers blame the MTA's deficit on costly building projects and say they shouldn't have to pay for the agency's funding mistakes. Not helping the situation at all were comments made on Wednesday by Mayor Richard Reardon during his monthly radio show on KFWBAM. Rather than trying to mend fences with the union and get buses back on the road, Reardon took his case to the airwaves, saying he supports breaking up the nation's second largest bus system into smaller geographic operations known as transit zones. He conceded that such a move would weaken the unions. And while the strike continues, over 400,000 daily bus riders in Los Angeles, mostly lower-income Black, Latino, and Asian riders who are public transport dependent, have been left stranded. Yet as buses and trains remain idle, bus riders are supporting the drivers against the MTA. We're joined now by Eric Mann, a representative of the Bus Riders Union in Los Angeles, and Chief Jaime de la Vega, who is deputy mayor and chief transportation advisor to Mayor Reardon and member of the MTA board.
Well, I'd like to begin with Jaime de la Vega, the deputy mayor. Could you tell us what the impact of the strike has been on the Los Angeles community?
Well, I think the strike has been very hard on everyone, especially those who depend on public transportation. But the issue here is the future of Los Angeles. Can the MTA expand its transit system? Can it provide more lifeline service for those who depend on public transportation? And can the MTA provide viable alternative to driving? That is why the MTA is trying to reduce costs.
Eric Mann is also joining us. He is a representative of the Bus Riders Union in Los Angeles, and which has been very vocal in supporting the strikers. Eric,
not to be confused with the Union of the Drivers.
Right. Eric, could you tell us why your organization decided to support the union?
Well, we decided to support the union because, first, we think the MTA has clearly provoked this strike with the union. This is a takeaway contract. This is not a massive expansion of drivers' wages and benefits. Second, because the MTA's deficit is because of massive rail expenditures, which are virtually in danger of bankrupting the entire agency. And third, because the MTA is really, once again, trying to get out of the bus business in any serious way. The reason they want to break the union and have lower wages is so they can, as Mayor Reardon and Jaime have indicated, deliver a low-wage package to private, if possible, bus companies who are going to provide terrible service. And they're going to say, now I have a low-wage workforce and I want to make a profit. And the way you make a profit is having old buses, bad service, and cheap drivers. But the final thing is this is a destruction of the entire public sector. It's taking a $3 billion agency that has the money to do its job, and it really wants to become a real agency for the wealthy and leave our people in the streets.
Deputy Mayor Vega, what about that? Are you seeking to basically privatize big sections of the public transit and break the union?
No, not at all. In fact, the MTA is facing a $500 million operating deficit over the next 10 years alone. What that means is the MTA is either going to have to increase its revenue or reduce its costs. And if the MTA cannot achieve those two goals, it will be forced to reduce service and jobs. What the mayor and the MTA board has committed is to protect both the existing workers and their union's right to represent those employees in the event zones are formed. And I need to tell you about zones a little bit more. Zones are simply smaller management units. The idea of getting savings is not on the backs of labor, as some have claimed. It's through better management and reduced overhead. And the smaller operators in Los Angeles County, they do use unionized labor. They're union shops, and for example, Santa Monica Transit here in Los Angeles County has been rated the number one bus operator for the fourth year in a row. So there can be good service, quality service, at a lower cost without breaking unions.
What's your response to that, Eric Mann?
Well, the situation is basically that the MTA shut down all its rail lines right now, and I mean it in the most serious way. The high visibility rail lines that still have enormous subsidies per passenger and enormous operating costs. Now maybe we'd be taking away service from 8% of the people, including some of our members who use rail as well as bus, but still 94% of the people using the bus. Right now, the MTA is moving right after this strike to cut bus service. We have a hearing on October 7th where the Bus Riders Union is negotiating with the MTA on takeaways about bus service when they're supposed to be expanding it. We're going to try to get them to take away all these cuts. Secondly, the MTA is threatening us with a fare increase right after the strike and even implying that our support for the drivers can lead to retaliation against the riders. Right now, a lot of our members are being held captive in Pacific Palisades because the rich people, the rich white people in Pacific Palisades, are saying to domestic workers that once you get out, you have to stay here for a week, and you have to work 18 hours a day as virtual captive labor because of the strike. There's no need for this strike. There's a need to end the rail system as we presently know it.
But
those are the choices. They're very hard choices. And the rail construction companies, including that many of the unions, are not talking about this. See, one of the problems is we're supporting the drivers, but the drivers are part of the AFL-CIO, and the construction unions are so powerful in the AFL-CIO that they love rail projects because it's a 3 to 4 year very good paying job for people, after which it's terrible transportation. So this is one of the crises that this is the elephant in the living room.
What about this issue that the rail lines basically serve the suburban white and upper income portions of the population, whereas the buses serve the poor? Why are you putting so much emphasis on the rail lines, Deputy Mayor?
Well, I think that's a little bit inaccurate. The MTA, as Eric pointed out, suspended all future rail lines. And if you look at the demographics of both the rail and bus population in Los Angeles, it's very similar. 3 in every 4 people on rail lines are minority or people of low income. So the rail system is a service for everyone.
So what is going to happen right now? You have the workers out on strike, the United Transportation Union representing 4,300 workers. You have many people who are not able to get to work or get around. What do you see happening, Eric Mann?
Well, we have a rally today at 11 o'clock. It's a rally with the drivers at City Hall asking Mayor Reardon, who has 4 votes on the board, including Jaime de la Vega, who's on the phone, to make a conciliatory response to the union and try to end this strike. We're not engaging in every zig and zag of the collective bargaining agreement. Secondly, we're asking the mayor and others to make a commitment to take away the cuts in bus service, which are presently being planned. That's not an expansion. And to take away the threats of an increase in the fare, which is going to probably come in another month or two. And if it does, it's going to lead to a massive confrontation. There was a time when the MTA was making enormous progress after they signed a consent decree with us to really make a significant improvement in the bus system. And there was a period for a couple of years, just up until about a year ago. But right now the MTA is in court. They're threatening to try to overturn the consent decree they signed with us. And I'll be honest with you, this is an agency that does not respect the agreements it signs with people. And it is right now making a major showdown with both the riders and the drivers.
Will that conciliatory gesture be made, Deputy Mayor Vega?
The mayor and other members of the board have been in daily contact with union leaders in Los Angeles, and we encourage the drivers union to come back to the table, and the MTA stands ready to talk. The MTA's package that it has put on the table would increase driver compensation and benefits by $43 million over the next 3 years. In exchange, the MTA is seeking flexibility in scheduling, which would produce $23 million in savings. That's a net benefit to the union members of $20 million.
Well,
that is something that is not being reported in the media, and the MTA considers the offer fair and reasonable and has a lot of respect for its workers.
We'll continue to follow the strike. I thank you for being with us, Chief Jaime de la Vega, Deputy Mayor, Chief Transportation Advisor to Mayor Reardon, and Eric Mann of the Bus Riders Union. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Julian Aldrich and Sidrek Franklin. Special thanks to Roman Hunt and Deepa Fernandez. Matthew Finch is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Broadcast out of the studios of WBAI in New York.